Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you to today's program, the 2010 midterm elections and the future of the Obama presidency. We're very pleased today to have with us the Washington Bureau Chief of Mother Jones, David Korn. My name is David DeWilde, and I'm a trustee of the World Affairs Council. Before we begin, let me say a quick word about the Council. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where the leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and informs action. If you'd like to learn more about the Council, please visit our website at www.itsyourworld.org. If you're unable to attend a program, we offer two excellent ways to stay connected. You can listen to our weekly radio broadcast, It's Your World, on Monday evenings at 8 p.m. on KQED. And on our website, you can find an audio and video archive of all of our past programs. So this is the time where everyone turns off all of their cell phones and any other electronic devices that might interrupt the program. And while you're doing that, I'd like to point out two upcoming programs that might be of interest to you. On Monday, October 25th, the President of the United States Institute of Peace, Richard Solomon, will join the Council to discuss the tactics American presidents employ when negotiating with their foreign counterparts. This event will take place here in the World Affairs Council Auditorium at 6 p.m. Then on Tuesday, October 26th, the World Affairs Council and the Global Philanthropy Forum are pleased to co-host the President and CEO of the International Rescue Committee, George Rupp, to discuss the challenges of implementing developmental programs in conflict zones. This event will also take place here at the World Affairs Council Auditorium at 12 p.m. Finally, you'll see that there are blue question cards on your chairs. Please write your questions and hand them to the Council staff members who will be located throughout the room. And it's my pleasure now to introduce our distinguished guest. David Korn is the current Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine, having spent 20 years as the Washington editor of The Nation. He's blogged for several news websites, including HuffingtonPost.com, CQPolitics.com, and The Guardian. He's the co-author of Hubris, the inside story of spin, scandal, and the selling of the Iraq War. A very good book that I've been, I'm about halfway through at the moment. It's great. And wrote The Lies of George W. Bush and Blonde Ghost, Ted Shackley and the CIA's Crusades. Mr. Korn has long been a prominent commentator on television and radio and regularly appears on programs, and you may have seen him, on Hardball, PBS's NewsHour, and Washington Week in Review. He has spoken, lectured, or debated at several colleges and universities, including Harvard, Cornell, and Yale. He's a lively, interesting, knowledgeable speaker. We are very fortunate to have him. Here to discuss the upcoming midterm elections, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming David Korn.
Thank you, David, and thank you to the World Affairs Council for having me come today. I was just on my smartphone a few moments ago checking the latest political news, and I don't know if any of you had a chance to hear this, but John McCain was asked if he had any regrets about picking Sarah Palin to be his running mate, and he said something different this time than he usually does. He said, well, you know, if I had to do it all over again, I think I would have picked Christine O'Donnell. He might have if he had known her at the time, don't you think? We're now, less than about a week and a half from historic elections. But then again, every elections are historic. I feel like we're living in a political science experiment, but I say that basically every 2 years. And in 2008, the way I described the political science experiment of that time was the question was being addressed, could the United States elect a black guy president? And we debated that for a good year and a half and finally had an answer. And we also thought, a lot of people thought, I think a lot of people in this room probably shared the belief, that the 2008 campaign marked something of a political victory, that in the way that, say, the San Francisco Giants might win a ball game. You know, a victory, you have a victory and it's done, and then you have your rewards. You get endorsements, you have champagne, and you move on to the next thing. But we have a different political science experiment going on right now. And the way I would describe that is really, we're testing the notion, how far will angry voters go in electing people who have no experience and who are unproven to be their elected representatives? I mean, I think that's the essence of what we've seen happening so far. And it also shows you that any sense of victory that one might have had after Election Day 2008 was truly ephemeral, and that there really is no such thing as ultimate or final victory in politics, that we literally have the same fights over and over and over again. And I know that's sometimes a depressing or discouraging thought, but but once you realize that, I think it makes the ups and downs perhaps the easier to contend with. I remember back in the 1984 campaign, Gary Hart campaigned on the notion of new ideas. It was time for new ideas. I think one or two people in this room may be old enough to remember that. And but at the time, it sounded good. It was sort of a good marketing device. But there really aren't new ideas. And if you look at what we contended with in 2008, what we're contending with now, it's very basic propositions of what government is about, how we organize ourselves as a community. And these battles are never won or lost permanently by either side. You had the Reagan years, and then you had Clinton come back and undo some of Reagan, but accepted some of it. And then you had the Bush years, and then Obama came in and had very activist government, and arguably saved the economy to a certain degree. And for that, he's been vilified by people who actually, I think, are driven more by the idea of anti-government than the actual results of what the government has done in the last year and a half. So the question is what's going to happen on Election Day, but more importantly, what happens the day after Election Day and the weeks and the months ahead. And it seems to me that the Tea Party has put a tremendous gravitational pull on the political system, which will end up having this pull on the governing system. And it's important to sort of understand, what is at the core of the Tea Party and just how far to the right or even off the charts they are, because this will be the constituents that many newly elected senators and members of Congress and some reelected members will feel they have to cater to. So let me just tell you a story that I did just a couple weeks ago to give you a sense of what we and what the Republican Party has to contend with. There was a fellow who was a congressman from the fifth, he still is, congressman from the 5th District of South Carolina, a Republican named Jim Inglis. He served six years, actually, in the 90s, took a break, and then came back 2004, got reelected again. He's in his third term in his newest, in his second phase of being a member of Congress. He has earned a 93% conservative ranking, lifetime conservative ranking, from the American Conservative Union, which is a pretty conservative spot, and their ratings are a pretty good indication of whether someone's conservative or not. This year, after really not having much of a contest ever in his district, there are very few Democrats, and he's been and he's he's matched the district in temperament and ideology. He had three or four, I forget, Tea Party challengers in the primary against him, running in the Republican primary. He ended up coming in second in the first round, and then there was a runoff against one of the Tea Party candidate who came in first, and he ended up losing, I don't know, by like 27%. It wasn't even close. And this is a fellow, he's a very interesting study. He kind of led the effort against Bill Clinton during the impeachment days because he was on the Judiciary Committee, and then he left shortly after that. Went to, you know, did some private business and then came back. And when he came back, he said, and he said publicly, I'd made a mistake. When I was here the first time around, we wasted time. We wasted time on the Clinton impeachment. We have real problems. We didn't deal with them. It was silly. And I consider what I did a sin. That's how he actually referred to it. And he came back kind of dedicated to the proposition that people, conservative Republicans and others, should, you know, roll up their sleeves and try to find solutions to some of our problems. And he actually cares about climate change. He didn't support cap and trade, and then some of us on the left didn't really like it much either, and came up with a whole new market-based solution for dealing with it, using the tax code. And whether it was wrong or not, it was a genuine effort. And he tried to get people on his, you know, on the Republican House side to sign on, and found nobody interested. He got a few Republicans who said, you know, it's a good idea. You know, if it wasn't for my constituents back home, I'd be all for this. So he goes into the campaign, and he knows it's a hard-fought campaign, and he's seeing that some of his longtime donors, people who have been giving him money, you know, since the early 90s, well, they're not making contributions this time. So he arranges to get four couples together at a dinner to sort of try to shake them down for money. This is what politicians do. And he's giving them his best pitch. And I don't know, half an hour into the meeting, one of them says, and he says, well, most of these couples are in their 60s, 70s. He gets halfway in the meeting, and one of them stops and he goes, Bob, you don't seem to understand. Barack Obama is a socialist communist, not a communist socialist, a socialist communist who wants to destroy this country, which is what health care is all about, and he's doing this so that he can then impose a dictatorship, open the borders to the Mexicans, and have a secret, and turn this into a Muslim nation. Yeah. And everyone else around the table goes, And Bob didn't know, Congressman Inglis didn't know what to say to that. And he came back to Congress and he told John Boehner about this. This is what I'm up against. This is what I'm facing back home. And Boehner said, well, you just should have told him you disagree with Barack Obama. You know, and we have some policy disagreements. He goes, you don't think I tried that? It's not good enough. And then he spoke to another member of Congress, another Republican, and said, well, you missed your real opportunity. You should have said, as long as I'm in Congress, that will never happen. And he would have been telling the truth. Right? But he also, you know, told me, you know, these are all stories that he told me when I did this interview with him after he lost his race. And they talk about a meeting he had with Tea Party activists, leading Tea Party activists from his district. And they're, you know, he's in one of their homes, and he's sitting there, they're talking about the debt and TARP and all these other things. And they get into the meeting. At some point, one of them says, well, you know that number on the back of your Social Security card? And he goes, yeah. Well, that's the number of the bank that owns you, that bought you when you were born on the basis of your lifetime earnings. And he sort of doesn't know what to say, and this guy starts going into a whole global conspiracy theory about international banks and the Bilderberg Society, which has connections to anti-Semitic, the protocols of the Elders of Zion conspiracies and so on. And he's kind of just nodding, and they can tell that he has no idea what they're talking about. And so they start yelling at him, "You're a congressman and you don't know this? What are you doing up there?" And so he was, for good reasons, very depressed by these sort of interactions. And I have to say, to his credit, didn't pander to these people. But he'll be unemployed, you know, come January because of that, and his political career is over. And those are the people who have provided the energy behind the Republic, you know, what I assume will be the Republican takeover of the House and the near takeover of the Senate. That's the best betting right now. So this is important for a number of reasons, because if you're looking forward and you look at the problems that the president has had working with the current Congress, where the Republicans are in the minority, if you start thinking about the new sort of Republican majority or near majority in the House and Senate there may be, the prospects aren't that good. You're going to have in the Senate, I think it's without question, the number of senators who believe climate change is not real or a hoax will go up, not go down. And you can see the trouble we've had, the trouble the president has had or environmental groups have had in trying to get legislation through the Senate. They passed a bill through the House and it hit a roadblock in the Senate. Ken Buck, who's running for Senate, he's a Tea Party candidate in Colorado. He was on Meet the Press last week, literally comparing homosexuality to alcoholism. He's called climate change one of the greatest hoaxes ever perpetuated on the American public. And I assume he means it. That's the scary thing. He's not pandering. He's telling people what he thinks. If you think about, there's a lot of talk recently about education reform in this country, and I do think it's one of the great hidden issues, and a tough issue politically, for the Democrats who don't want to challenge unions, and for the Republicans who don't want to spend money, and who have a social conservative base that worry about any government intervention in education so students might learn about, say, evolution. But in education, you have Sharon Engel, who stands a very, very good chance of defeating the Senate Majority Leader in Nevada, Harry Reid, saying that she has said she wants to abolish the Department of Education, as well as the EPA, as well as privatized the Veterans Administration. I mean, one of the great things, and one of the few places where healthcare works in this country, actually is in the VA. They have a great computer system. They give, they have a high quality care. There have been problems with Walter Reed and other things, but by and large, it works better than the private system. On the healthcare front, there are unresolved battles left from the legislation, and how you implement it is key. A lot of regulations still have to be written, and a lot will depend on the oversight of the insurance industry that is managed by the Department of HHS and other government bodies. Well, there's a whole move to repeal it or cut back certain aspects of it. And if you're in the House, you can just deny funding to the federal, you don't have to undo the law. You can just deny funding to the government bodies that are charged with overseeing and making healthcare reform work. Immigration. Again, this festering wound of a policy issue. You in California, I've seen this go on for 30 years now politically. And you have people who, if they get elected on the Republican side, will partly have gotten elected because they ran ads demonizing brown-skinned people and denouncing what they call amnesty and blaming illegal immigration, some of them blaming even legal immigration, for America's economic woes. These people are not going to be much of a mind to work out what is the obvious grand compromise. Do something with a wall, make a moat, but at the same time have a path for citizenship for the
for the folks who are here, and figure out what to do to unite families and so on. I mean, anybody who works on this policy matter in Washington will tell you that like 80%, there's 80% consensus amongst policy people on what sort of has to be done. We have, other big issue, of course, is it's just the federal government and its role in terms of dealing with economic downturns and the social safety net, let alone Social Security or Medicare. And you have people coming in who really believe, and it's kind of interesting because a lot of them get Medicare, the government should be smaller and do less for people. I mean, Sharon Angle said unemployment benefits just spoil people. They just spoil people. They give you a disincentive from working because you get that $242 a week or whatever it might be. Obama's going to, and the Democrats are going to have a very hard time finding any common ground on either rebuilding, revising, or sustaining a social safety network in a time of what we obviously is going to be long-term austerity. There's no economist who believes that we're going to, drop from 10% unemployment for years, if even at that point. I mean, if you look at what's happened in Europe, their normal has been unemployment from 8, 9, 10% or to the low teens, and they've gotten used to it, but they've had a more serious social safety net to sort of compensate for that structural unemployment. We now see in France and other places in England where they've had these tremendous government cutbacks that that's all kind of, ripping apart. They have to figure out what to do. But in the United States, our acceptable level of unemployment has been much lower, 5 to 7%. But now it's going to go, if it stays at 10% and we don't have that social safety network of the Europeans have, there are going to have to be some very hard debates here about how we treat people who end up, falling through the holes in the economy or through that safety net. And the Republican caucus in the House and Senate is taking a giant step to, I don't care. I wouldn't say not, I don't care. Maybe not my problem, until something, of course, happens to them. So there's not going to be much incentive for working together. And, politics is largely, you can understand politics largely by looking at, incentives and disincentives. And the folks coming in are not going to have incentives to reach out or to solve a lot of these issues because they're there because they're basically don't have solutions and don't think government is a place to come up with solutions, which is really the fundamental divide. And in the Senate, which we've all seen in the last year and a half, it really only takes one. I mean, Jim Bunning, senator from Kentucky, who may be replaced by Rand Paul. One fun fact about Rand Paul, if you don't know this already, he belongs to a group of conservative doctors, and they have a website. And during the campaign, they posted on their website a piece by one of their members that said that Obama, maybe it was after the election, that said Obama had won the election literally because he hypnotized Jewish people. And this wasn't metaphoric. It explained that he used key words and said them in such a way that Jewish people were entranced and voted for him, even though he would destroy Israel. This is not something that Rand Paul did when he was in college. He hangs out with these people now. But we saw with Jim Bunning that he could hold up unemployment benefits for millions of Americans on his own. The Senate rules allow that to happen. We've seen hundreds, literally hundreds of non-controversial appointees from the Clinton administration languish in the Senate. And, because of one or two folks. Now you're going to have a sort of just say no coalition Michelle Bachmann has the Tea Party caucus in the House, and there's going to be a Just Say No Tea Party caucus led by Jim DeMint in the Senate. And these people really don't mind looking out of step. I mean, Jim DeMint has, and they don't mind taking losses. They don't mind being excoriated. Jim DeMint, you know, when Christine O'Donnell beat Mike Castle, and the Republicans really seemed to lose any chance of getting that seat, which might be, we don't know yet, but might be the seat that determines whether it goes, whether the Senate can go Republican or not. Jim DeMint said, I don't care about losing the Delaware Republican Senate seat. I'm happy that a conservative won the primary. That is more important to me. I don't play these calculating games. And he means it. He means it. Everybody else is saying, even a lot of Republicans were saying, God, this was a dumb move for us. And he said, I don't care. I'm going to do what I think is right. And, you know, Rand Paul's father, Ron Paul, is proud of the 357 times there's been a 434-1 vote in the House, and he's been the one vote. I made up the stats, but, you know, it happens quite often. There's a 434-1 vote in the House, and the one vote is Ron Paul. Now, when you do it in the House, it doesn't matter. If you do that in the Senate, and you're the one vote, and you want to put a hold on a bill, then it does matter a lot. And they can gum up the works on anything, you know, whether it's military spending, climate change, in the months to come. You know, the argument from the right is that Obama, you know, hasn't really tried compromising himself and hasn't reached out to us. You know, I think that's a lot of bunk. You know, and I think part of the problem has been that Obama has compromised in a way that weakened him politically. And a good example of that to me is the stimulus. And I believe in compromise. I believe in Washington that sometimes you have to compromise to get something through. But, you know, when he originally was talking about stimulus, a lot of economists, you might have noticed that Paul Krugman has made this point 100 or 200 times in the last 6 months. A lot of economists thought the stimulus should be bigger, over a trillion, 1.5 trillion. And there were three, at that time, Republican members of the Senate who insisted it be below a trillion. So Obama cut it for them. And what's happened is that the stimulus really probably wasn't big enough. It did enough to keep unemployment from going up to 12 to 13%. But it still went up from 8 to 9.6. And so the Republicans had this great talking point. You spent almost $1 trillion, and unemployment still went up. Now, if he had spent twice as much, unemployment might have gone down a little bit, maybe 1, 2, 3, you know, points. And then, you know, they wouldn't have made that argument. But the thing that he failed to do at the time, and this is why compromises have to come with the right story. It sounds kind of childish, but it's really true in politics. You have to tell the right story to contextualize your actions, because by and large, people don't have the time to, you know, read the newspapers, watch cable, Mother Jones, or the National Review, and really understand all the details. They don't. They need things to be summed up in a way that is accurate and that more importantly, resonates with them. So Barack Obama at the time was free to say, I want $1.5 trillion. I don't think we can do this without much money. But these guys won't give it to me. They just simply won't, and they're going to filibuster. So my choice is now to take, you know, two-thirds of a loaf, and because that's still going to be better than nothing. It's still going to help 2-3 million people as opposed to 5-6 million people. And I'm going to take what I can, and we'll see how it goes, and I'll come back for more if we need it. So then, if he had made an argument of that nature, then a year later, when they're all saying, oh, you know, unemployment hasn't gone down, but economists are saying, hey, he saved 2 to 3 million jobs this way, he can go out and say, see, I told you so. I told you things wouldn't go as well as they needed to if this is all the stimulus you gave me. This is why we needed more. And this is why I'm going to come back and try to get more. At least, you know, and I'm not sure how the public would have responded to that, But it would have been an argument, a political argument, a political narrative to challenge, you know, frankly, the lies that John Boehner and Eric Cantor and House and Senate Republicans are saying when they said not a single new job was created by the stimulus. I'm being given the high sign, and I really want to, you know, address your questions. So I'll try to wrap up very quickly here. And so I think, you know, we're heading into a period which is going to be a lot like the 90s, very bitter and partisan, but the Republicans are going to have sort of two things going for them at once. One is they're going to be more extreme than the Newt Gingrich Republicans, if, you know, imagine ever thinking that. But also, they're going to be more savvy than the Newt Gingrich Republicans. The leadership of the House and Senate Republicans, a lot of them lived through the 90s, and they saw the mistakes they made. And, you know, how through reaching too far or having bad messaging, trying to shut down the federal government so people didn't get their Social Security checks. Brilliant move, Newt. And so, so they've learned some of those lessons. So I would expect them, and I don't think John Boehner and Eric Cantor are the brightest political strategists that we've seen in our, you know, in a generation or two. But they still, because of having, for having gone through the 90s, will be, you know, be smarter than maybe Newt and Richard and Dick Armey had been. So you're going to have this real, and, you know, there'll be some tensions within the Republican Party, but I don't think it's going to explode in the next 2 years. And Obama's going to really have some very hard decisions in deciding how to address this and how to confront this, whether to try to get some things done or just, you know, take a Harry Truman approach, spend 2 years campaigning against them and calling them out again and again and again and saying, you know, you folks elected me to get above this partisan ideological wrangling. I tried, and I see it can't work with these people. It can't work. They don't believe climate change is real. They don't believe government should help people. They are telling you that your taxes have gone up when your taxes have gone down. They're not honest. I can't work with them. And I say this regrettably, and I say this with you in mind, because I can't help you. And so he has to do a Jerry Maguire type of thing. Help me to help you. and see if that can rally people for 2012. Because, you know, I mean, right now, it really looks like the Phillies have a better chance of reaching the World Series than Obama will have of cutting any significant policy deals with the Republicans. And again, I don't say this to discourage people because, you know, in retrospect, a backlash was somewhat inevitable, but that this is just the natural ebb and flow. And politics are never over. History never ends. You know, we said at the end of the Cold War, you know, that history was over. It never ends. And this goes all the way back to Adams versus Jefferson when they were putting their political opponents in jail under the Alien Sedition Act. So people who care, you know, just have to, as Rahm Emanuel once said, buck up. But I don't mean buck up to, you know, to bend over for the Democrats, but you just have to realize that this is it's always a long-term fight with no end. And with that, I'm just going to remind people that I work for Mother Jones, and if you don't know it, please check it out. And just as important, we have a wonderful 24/7 website, motherjones.com. I have 8-9 reporters in Washington who I manage, who are constantly digging out facts about politics and policy, climate change and gay rights and what's happening in the White House, what's happening with the Republican caucus. And we're going to be continuing doing this after the election. You know, I think, you know, unfortunately, I think what's going to happen is going to be good for my business, although maybe not good for the business of the country. And you can also find us, of course, and me, on Facebook and on Twitter. So I've gone over my time. I have to leave in 20 minutes. So let's go through questions as fast as we can. Thank you.
Well, there are a lot of questions,
okay.
A lot of good, interesting questions. I'm going to try to cluster them to make it a little more efficient. There are several people that have asked questions focused on the Tea Party. One says that the Tea Party seems to lack any sense of a foreign policy and what will happen if they're faced with real international issues. Before you get in, let me give you a couple of the others that you can perhaps weave them together. And then there are several questions about the source of the Tea Party's anger and beliefs. Where does this thinking come from? Ignorance, leadership from Fox News, current bad economic conditions.
Okay. Oh, that's the Tea Party and foreign policy. That's a really good question, because the Tea Party is not a party, and it's not an organization. It's, you know, it's a shorthand term to describe, you know, a certain sentiment. And within the Tea Party, there are a lot of different, you know, and sometimes conflicting sentiments. There's a libertarian wing of the Tea Party. There's some more social conservative wing. And, you know, they've stayed away, the Tea Party folks in general, from social conservative issues, abortion, gay rights, although they've tried to, you know, embrace some of the energy of the old religious right populist movement. But on foreign policy, the libertarians would say, you know, get out of Afghanistan, don't spend so much money. Now, the more traditional conservatives, a lot of Tea Party folks are just what we just used to call Reagan conservatives, you know, are going to say, well, we got to win in Afghanistan. And right now, because Afghanistan is really a non-issue politically, the Tea Party and its candidates have not really had to address this internal conflict or dilemma. They can put it aside the way Democrats have done as well. Most Democrats are opposed to Obama's policy in Afghanistan, and they haven't made a stink about it. I think all this is built, you know, I've been predicting, my editors here, they know this, I've been predicting for years now that Afghanistan's going to become a political issue, and I've been wrong. But I think it's going to become a political issue. Because Obama has, you know, a self-imposed July 2011 deadline to begin some form of withdrawal. The generals have a counterinsurgency program that really, for it to succeed, has to be on a 5, 10, 15-year glide path. The two things can't really coexist. So Obama's going to have some hard decisions to make. And Republicans in general in Congress have been, you know, gung-ho and been saying stick it out as long as possible, while at the same time, popular opinion is against the war of Republicans and Democrats. So there are a lot of conflicting, you know, waves and different tidal pulls here. But while it hasn't become an issue on Capitol Hill or in Washington, none of this has had to be resolved. So to me, it's going to be very interesting if it does become a political issue in the spring, where are some of these Tea Party candidates going to be? I mean, Rand Paul, you know, if he follows his father's lead, would be for immediate disengagement. Remember what Ron Paul got into, you know, was attacked by Rudy Giuliani in 2008 for saying we shouldn't be in Iraq. I mean, that is sort of, you know, there is a far-right populist libertarian view that doesn't like any of these overseas entanglements, doesn't believe it's worth our lives or our dollars. And so there will be some parts of the Tea Party where that will be expressed. You know, what does Sharon Engel think about this? Does Sharon Engel think about this? I mean, I don't know, but I think this is, I mean, you know, this will be an interesting theme to watch. Now, the source of anger and beliefs of Tea Partiers, I mean, I think, you know, there are different levels of it. And I think that, you know, I mentioned that some are social conservatives, some are, you know, more libertarian. I think some, there was a political cultural component to it, that when Barack Obama won, and I think there was some race element of race to this, but not for everybody. It was like the other America won. Harvard, intelligent, articulate, you know, policy-minded, you know, it's like that's not my America. Larry Summers isn't my America, and this guy doesn't, you know, eat pork rinds like George H.W. Bush famously did. He doesn't sound like a cowboy like George W. Bush did. And he's just, you know, he's the Northeast liberal, you know, all those things they've ever said.
And And he's black.
Well, that's what I said. I think for some, there was that. But some didn't have to get to the black. Some had enough, were offended by him prior to that. And so that, I think, started at the beginning. And then, as the economy got worse, and as they saw bailout money going to other elites, organized by Geithner and Robert Rubin, you know, that pissed them off too. And it was like, here are all the elites ganging up against us. Now, they didn't realize it was driving them into the arms of, or into an alliance with Wall Street lobbyists and the banks and the people who created the problem to begin with. And I think, you know, on healthcare, there was a lot of demagoguery that they were susceptible to. They wanted to believe the worst about Barack Obama, and they were told these would create, you know, there would be death panels and the like. And there was always the resentment that this is one of the major themes of American politics. Resentment that government is taking money from me, taxes, and giving it to somebody else. And people saw healthcare as that. You know, one of the big secrets about healthcare is that if you ask people in the polls if they're satisfied with their health insurance, a majority say yes. Now, we have 50 million people without, and it creates a lot of problems with the economy. But more people are satisfied than not. The problem is that a lot of those people haven't had a problem yet with their health care, so it hasn't been tested. And people were, a lot of independents, not necessarily Tea Partiers, but a lot of independents were very skeptical of, you know, sort of the devil you know in some ways is better than the Obamacare you don't, especially when they're talking about death panels and that you'll have to make changes. So there were a lot of different things hitting people at the time. America seems to be losing economic vitality. You can worry about China if you want. We're stuck in two wars. Not much good is going on. And Obama became a very, very easy target, you know, whether people were racially motivated or just fearful or directed by, you know, conservative strategists like Dick Armey, who poured a lot of money into the Tea Party. And so you end up with a movement that called, as I said earlier, that decries big government, and they, you know, want to make sure nothing happens with Medicare. And the argument about Obamacare, one of the big arguments Republicans make is, you know, it's going to squeeze $500 million, supposedly in savings, out of Medicare. So there, they don't want to touch a government program, but they don't want government to do anything. The thing about politics, though, is there's no law that says it has to make sense. It just has to ring true to people. And that's where I think Obama, as I said earlier, failed. You know, what he was doing didn't ring true to people.
That leads into some other questions. And one person asks, in my opinion, President Obama should emphasize more and very specifically how Republican control of the House is not favorable to the middle class. And that kind of ties in with the headline on your current issue, attack on the middle class.
Thank you, David. That's a good promotion. Well, I mean, I'll do this one short. He has said that, you know, many times, but I don't think he has done it in a way that is registered, because he has tried at some moments to say, I'm negotiating, I'm working with them. At other points, he has said, I can't negotiate, I can't compromise with these people. And he's given a very mixed message from the very beginning of his presidency. And so in the last, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks, he's come out and he's hit them hard as being the party of just say no, and they can't work with these people, and they're working with special interests and secret campaign money from foreign companies or domestic corporations. And he's, you know, if you make this argument to anyone in the White House, they will whip you out all the things in his speeches that he has said that you believe he should say. But I don't think he's done it in a manner from the beginning that's in part of a coherent narrative, where his actions and his words all sort of send a very simple story. I mean, I say that, you know, we live in a world where we're bombarded with information in this information age. I talked to one consultant a few months ago. He said that he had heard from someone who studies this, that each day the average person gets about 4,000 messages of some sort. Maybe that's clean up your room, but I mean, it's a lot of different things. And people who pay attention, who read newspapers, or go online to MotherJones.com, probably get more than 4,000 messages a day. If you follow me on Twitter, you get more than 4,000 messages a day. And so, you know, what I tell people in politics, and whenever they're dumb enough to ask my advice, is I say, well, there are two words you have to remember: baseball bat. People see you when you swing a baseball bat, especially if you hit them over the head with it. And, you know, these nuances, well, he said, you know, remember the Wall Street reform fight? Some weeks he would call on the bankers and say, I need your help, because this isn't so bad. And then other weeks he'd go out and say, you know, they've hurt our economy, they must do the right thing. And, you know, none of this ever really cut through in a clear way. He had to sort of make a decision which way he's going to play it. You know, unfortunately, nuance just doesn't work. You know, we have more information, and which should lead us to be in a position where we can better evaluate information, but instead we can't. So what registers is when something is bold and blunt. Now, it has to be tethered, I hope, to the truth and accurate, but you have to find a way to do it with a cannonball. And he didn't do that.
There are a lot of very good questions. There are several people who are interested in Obama's advisors. As someone asked if there's any chance that Robert Reich or Joseph Stiglitz would be moving into the administration. And then another person asked, would the return of David Plouffe improve the White House messaging?
Well, I always believe that that you should blame the person at the top first and foremost. Because especially when they're smart. I mean, Obama's a very smart fellow. He can see what was happening. And he's had a very close circle of advisors, much smaller than some of the past presidents, you know, with Rahm and David Axelrod and Robert Gibbs and Valerie Jarrett. And I don't think they've been very good at sort of taking in inputs and figuring out how to factor that into their decision making. I'd be shocked if Stiglitz or Robert Reich would become a part of this administration. But the good news is that Elizabeth Warren is now part of the administration. I actually spent part of a day with her earlier this week on her first day in the new offices for the Consumer Protection Board. And part of her job is setting this up, but her other part of her job is actually advising the president. And she's been advising him on the foreclosure crisis. And I don't, you know, I can imagine she won't tell me what she says. She's not supposed to, but I don't think it's a big secret the position she'd be taking in that. And you know, the problem has been really that the administration hasn't used her and others like her in a more visible role from the beginning. And now, you know, they're really stuck playing catch up when it comes to looking like they are being convincing people that they're on the side of the middle class. You know, David Plouffe was, you know, ran the Obama campaign, was a great strategist, smart fellow. Then he kind of went off and wrote a book and made money doing consulting. And he and Axelrod will be, you know, are still in charge. And I don't expect any dramatic turns because of shuffling around. But I really think the decision has to come, as I said earlier, from Obama. And he has to decide the tone and the story he wants to tell in the second half of his first and maybe only term.
I think you've to some extent perhaps covered this, but there are some questions about other decisions by Obama. Should he have concentrated on the job problems more than health care reform first in his term, in terms of the priorities?
I mean, that's one of the conventional indictments against Obama, that he was seen as caring more about a pet project, health care, than jobs. And I think, you know, in retrospect, you know, they put a lot of time into it, and certainly because our perception grew, it was a mistake. I think the Republicans used it and helped gin it up, but that doesn't make it any less effective. And if he had done earlier what I suggested earlier and sort of told a more overarching story about his economic efforts, it may have sort of given him some cover on that. But also, the strategic miscalculation was, you know, spending so many months trying to negotiate with Republicans on the Senate side. This thing really got bogged down, and it became very confusing. It was a confusing bill to begin with. And look, when he took office, he had a 68% approval rating. Congress, on a good day, maybe got into the low 30s. And so he had this great project, which is incredibly complex. And no one can be expected to read it and understand all the various provisions. And in politics, people look for surrogates. They want to say, okay, this is Obama's bill. I trust Obama for these reasons. This is Boehner's bill. I don't trust Boehner for those reasons, or vice versa. And whose bill it is, whose proposal it is, matters tremendously. And he kind of took a step back and said, well, here are some principles, Congress, you go to it. And I never understood the sense in identifying his number one domestic initiative, healthcare reform, with Max Baucus. I mean, Max Baucus did, I think, the best job he could, but most Americans are not going to look at that and have a lot of confidence. And especially as it got bogged down and took for time, and there was a whole delay that led to the death panel charge. So it still might have worked out the same politically, but I think there were a lot of steps the White House could have taken to protect themselves politically while pursuing health care reform.
What do you think of Obama's approach to national security? There's been an accusation that we're spending way too much money on this, and there's a lot of waste in this endeavor.
Well, I think, Gates, Secretary of Defense Gates, to some extent, has, made this a quasi-priority more than any other recent defense secretary. But, they get bombarded by members of both parties on the Hill who don't want to cut programs that are in their districts or that lobbyists lobby them for. I think, by and large, Obama, has made, what's above token? The next step above token steps towards dealing with some wasteful programs. He's cut some, he's gone after a few big ticket programs, which I think is really the only way to take a big whack at the budget. You can try to, find the little pockets of waste here and there, but it's really the big programs that are not necessary, that have to be zeroed out, that save you money. But at the same time, I think, politically, my guess is he figures there are only so many fights he can pick. And he's working with the Pentagon on Afghanistan that he's largely at odds with. And it's very easy, through leaks and other things, for these guys to undermine the president. I'm not even talking 7 days in May. We've seen, them try to put pressure on him. We've seen him push back. And it's and with everything else going on in terms of, the economy, the beginning of his term, it just hasn't been a priority. And I think the only way you make progress on this front is by making it a priority. And I think it was still a little bit away from Obama believing he has the political space to do that.
This is we have a lot of very good questions that was impossible to get to. I think the audience has been very on top of this. Could you talk a little bit longer term about the presidential election in 2012, particularly which Republican do you think is most likely to get nominated? Which Republican is most likely?
Okay, show of hands. Who thinks Sarah Palin's going to run? Okay. Who thinks she's not going to run? Okay, you're both right. Nobody knows. I don't even know if she knows yet. I mean, she obviously is keeping the door open. So without knowing whether she's running or not, you can't really know what the outcome's going to be. She will be the 800-pound grizzly in the room. And, I think, even though He's a flip-flopping Mormon who supported health care in Massachusetts. I still think Mitt Romney looks pretty good if you're betting, because he talks, you know, he knows how to talk about the economy. And my presumption is that we'll still have very high unemployment and a lot of economic angst, and a sort of daddy CEO figure will be reassuring to some. The question will be whether he can make it through the Republican primaries, where there will be a lot of social conservatives or evangelicals who are skeptical of Mormonism, and some libertarians who don't like what he did in Massachusetts, even though he has run from that. But if Palin runs and Huckabee runs, they might split to some degree the social conservative vote. There's just really no way of gaming this out. For a political journalist, it's going to be heaven, because they're just interesting people. The dynamics are all going to be very interesting, except Tim Pawlenty. He's not that interesting, but and often Republicans win nominations because they're not somebody. John McCain really won because he wasn't Mitt Romney and he wasn't Huckabee. Republicans didn't like, in fact, Republicans famously don't like John McCain, yet he won the nomination. So I'm assuming that there's going to be a lot of catering to the Tea Party, and a lot of the Tea Party energy will continue to flow into these primaries, which will, push all these folks, further and further to the right, if there is any room left there. But it's and again, I go as for how the general election shakes out. I think it really just depends on this sort of major decision that Obama makes after Election Day. What his overall story is going to be.
Let me squeeze in one last, and this ought to be a very quick answer. What do you think is Hillary Clinton's political future?
To be the subject of endless speculation. She's not going to challenge Barack Obama. Could she run in 2016? She still, I think, will be younger than Ronald Reagan was. But she's also a woman, and does an older woman have a better or less chance, of running? Look at politics this way. On January 20th, 2009, would anyone have thought we'd be at this point on October 22nd, 2010? Nobody, really nobody. Not even the Republicans, not even their wildest dreams. People are talking about the end of the Republican Party, the total end. So, looking at what's going to happen in 2012, let alone 2016, it's kind of a mug's game, but the one thing about the Clintons that you can that I think we can say with 100% certainty is that they never really go away. So she'll be a force, and we haven't seen either of them die yet. But until while they're with us, to their dying days, for good and for bad, I will expect Bill and Hillary to be part of the equation.
Please.
So I think I have to run, unfortunately. Yeah, yeah.
Please join me.
Thank you so much. Great questions.
Thank you, David, very much for your thoughts and insights.
Thank you, David. That was great.